The following programming is sponsored by Carol Captus Holloway. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
Well, good Monday afternoon. We are excited to bring you the final part three of our cyber series, and we have an amazing guest today. You are listening to Tell Me More with Carol Holloway, and after we finish our third part series of cybersecurity, we have an amazing guest. You don't want to leave the show. We have John Mattinger on, an award-winning author, a narcotics agent, a criminal investigator who wrote the book Lethal Doses, the story behind the godfather of fentanyl. I have so many questions to ask John. I can't wait till he joins us in just a little bit. We are live right here at WWDB on the air at 8:60 a.m. on the podcast, as well as on Facebook today for your listening pleasure and Odyssey. We are open to questions. If you have any questions or comments through Instagram and Facebook under Tell Me More with Carol Holloway. So to kick off the third part of our series on cybercrime, anybody that uses a computer today, as we've been talking about over the past couple weeks, knows that cybercrime is running rampant. It's not so much that we're not protecting ourselves. It's just that the criminals have gotten more involved. They understand the digital landscape. They understand how they can zero in on employers, employees, and consumers. We have lost so much money. In 2023, cyber attacks affected more than 340 million victims globally. Oh my gosh, that's like $3 billion in losses just last year, just so you know. So if you missed parts one and two, please go back over the past 2 weeks. But I want to jump right into our guest today because I really want to spend some extra time, if possible. No offense to our guest coming up, but I really want to spend some extra time with Lethal Doses, the author, and talking about that. However, David Shepard is here to join us. He is going to help us understand a little bit more about cybersecurity and what are some of the latest findings. He'll probably repeat some of the statistics I've given you. David has 20 years of experience in technology and software companies and held various European and global pre-sales and technical roles at companies such as Westcon, AppleSense, Landesk. And since the formation of his company Invante in 2017, he has been instrumental in building out the Invante team, providing support for solutions for customers in the workplace and consumers everywhere. So let's bring him right on board. I know he's waiting on the line.
Hi, Carol.
Hi, David. We have been talking about cybersecurity for the past 3 weeks on our show. I can't seem to drill it into people's heads how important it is because still people are resisting changing their email passwords. I hope you can be the one that helps us help people understand why it's important. There was a survey that was recently done, and the latest survey found some findings that people may be surprised to hear. Can you share with our listeners what that is?
Yeah, the survey we did aimed to shed light on how companies can strike a balance between securing the company and ensuring a positive user experience. We went out to 20,000 IT professionals, security experts, IT leads and executives. The kind of the headline stat that came back, 86% of IT professionals said poor user experience leads to unsafe workarounds being introduced by workers. And look, an example of this, look, it's proven when an employee gets tech friction or gets frustrated, they often try and find a workaround. The survey showed that one in two office workers admit to using personal devices for work activities, and 32% claimed that their company was unaware they were doing this. So obviously user experience drives a key part here. And the flip side of that is only 13% of IT security professionals said that user experience was important and mission critical to adopting cybersecurity tech interventions. So you can see we've got a huge divide there between how we roll out security and how the users adopt it.
Right. And that is very common. I mean, your statistics prove it, that people do get frustrated with company security processes and do end up using their own computer or their own cell phone, which may not have the cyber technical stuff that they need, right?
Yeah, right, correct. Like simple down to things like authentication, right? Using a device to authenticate yourself. If you're not rolling out that technology and you have a personal device, then your personal device can access. So yeah, it becomes very uncontrolled. And the pointer there was that if a company isn't aware of that, they are then unaware of the risk as well.
So a lot of people find that company security isn't very user-friendly, and we as creatures of habit go back to where we feel safe and secure. What can companies do?
Yeah, look, I think there is a commitment here from the software providers to the companies to gain a certain level of security. For example, at Avanti, we follow something called Secure by Design, which is a pledge and a framework created by the US Cybersecurity Infrastructure and Security Agency, CISA, that means that software providers deliver solutions that have these secure by design principles. And it gives the customer a level of satisfaction that security policies and processes are being met, but actually it takes some of the risk away. How does that help user experience? Well, in turn, it allows organizations to maybe focus a bit more on user experience. Our survey found that only 37% of organizations involve the security team in the user experience initiatives. So actually, if we can free some of the security team's time up by a secure by design pledge, it means these organizations are then able to focus more on user experience, but how we combine that with security as well.
Wow. David, this is a tough one for me. AI is everywhere, and I'm curious to know how it is affecting the cybersecurity landscape, because there's so many fakes out there in AI. Can this affect it?
Yeah, because generative AI plays causes some serious problems for security teams. Uncontrolled AI means that we get users using tools, for example, ChatGPT or AI tools that are unregulated. And this creates challenges around data privacy, compliance, cyber risks, even copyright. We don't know where the data is that they're accessing, and we don't know where that data is that we're potentially sharing as well. So it's quite a concern. And also what AI does, it can increase the number of attacks on your organization also. They become clever in terms of how they're trying to extract information from the user. The key part here is that 81% of the workers we surveyed also said they hadn't been trained on AI. So they were using potentially AI tools without training. And also 15% did say they were using unsanctioned tools. So these are AI tools that are being used in a work environment but haven't been approved by the organization to use. So it's from a data perspective, from a usage perspective, from a attack perspective, AI is something that all organizations need to be in control of and governing as well.
Are you finding that companies are lacking in that?
Yeah, immediately. I think the 81% statistic about not being trained, I think actually that shows that the companies, I think they're aware, but I just think the speed and the rate of how it's evolving, it becomes a challenge for organizations to keep up.
So for our listeners and our business owners and business people in charge of the security, what are some of the things that they can look for to make sure that they are safe online? And what are some of the things that they can do to stay away from the latest cyber attacks?
Yeah, I mean, some of it, you mirror what you're seeing in your workplace, right? But that and the consumer world and the workplace does get similar in terms of devices and applications. But the four things I go for: be cautious of unsolicited messages that ask for personal information. They might ask to share credentials. Never share anything like that with the unknown. Passwords. Passwords remain a staple part of security, but they need to be strong. They need to be long. They need to be random. And they need to use a variety of characters that are available on your keyboard. The one technical point I'll use here is multi-factor authentication, MFA, making sure that when you put a password in to get onto your social platforms, as an example, make sure you have the prompt to your device or to your email that allows you to double authenticate into your platforms. That really guarantees security. And then finally, keep all software and devices up to date. So all the applications you use, all your devices, when you're prompted for that update, take that update because it brings you to the latest level of security.
David, are the password keepers that we have on our computers, you know, like with Microsoft or Google or something like that, the Google password keeper, are they safe to keep our passwords in?
They really are. And that is a really good approach to managing your passwords. Password managers on your devices, on your desktops, on your devices, are a very, very good method of managing your passwords.
Okay. And help me. How often should we be changing our passwords? You know, a lot of people, especially our elderly, they don't want to deal with it. They just want to, you know, click and save and it's there and that's it. So how often should we be doing it?
It's an interesting conversation. I could probably talk a long time. I would, you know, you do need to regularly change your passwords. That is a factor. Changing it too much means you could, you know, there's the forgetting issue, which is where password manager comes in. So I would always say change your passwords when you are prompted to. Use a password manager then to enable you to change the passwords to a complex password that you're not always then having to remember as well.
Okay, great information. So we do it whenever they tell us they need to be changed and we be super careful. And sometimes we'll get those text messages. We've discussed this over the past couple of weeks, but it's really nice to drill it again. You know, we get those messages that your account has been compromised and yep. Your advice when we get something through our phone or our email that we're like, oh, well, I didn't know that happened. Let me call this number. Tell our listeners again what they should be doing.
Yeah, they should definitely be not responding to those messages if they're unknown, even if they look familiar and it might be from an organization you use. Go to the website, ring the numbers from the website, ensure that you are making your own approach into those organizations and not responding to those messages, because otherwise it can become really serious from a security perspective.
David, I appreciate your time here and helping us complete our series on cybersecurity, but our listeners probably still have more questions. Where can they go for more information?
If you go to avanti.com and then /secured experience, this gives you all the information we talked about today and much more.
And that's Avanti, I-V-A-N-T-I. Why Avanti? What makes them special?
So yeah, we specialize on delivering a secure experience to organizations. Wherever a employee might be. So that secured experience means that organizations can have a level of trust that their employees, whichever applications they're running, are safe and secure, and the employees are able to work from everywhere under the safe impression that they are secure at all times.
Awesome. Thank you for joining us. And hopefully after doing this for a couple of weeks, people are listening and they're doing what they need to do. Thank you for your time, David.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Happy that we were able to conclude three parts of this series on cybersecurity. If you want more information, please go to avanti.com. You can also check out statistics on forbes.com/advisor. And plenty of information there if you want to know how many billions of dollars have been lost in this industry. Coming up next, my wonderful guest is going to be here. John Mattinger is online. You can view him on Facebook. I think we have him up and running, even though I'm not showing today. I have been under the weather, so I don't want to scare my listeners because, you know, I can do the show in my pajamas and you would never know. But today, not the same. Let's take a quick commercial break and bring John on board. He is the author of Lethal Doses, the story behind the Godfather of Fentanyl. Can't wait to talk to him. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Carol Holloway from Home Improvement Fix and Facts. Listen to me live every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 right here at WWDB. And if you can't listen live, make sure you go to WWDBAM.com and listen to my podcast. Each week, we will give you great ideas on how to fix your home and some facts on how to put it all together. In the middle of our streets, our house.
Hey, Philadelphia homeowners. To build for looks and durability, side your home with LP SmartSide Expert Finish Trim and Siding, now available in brushed smooth texture. Available in 16 versatile colors, LP SmartSide Expert Finish products will help you create a gorgeous, longer-lasting dream home. That's the beauty of brushed smooth. Learn more about LP SmartSide Expert Finish products in brushed smooth texture at lpcorp.com/Philly Siding. That's lpcorp.com/Philly Siding.
Hello, this is Erin, and I have a very important message. If you or a loved one is suffering with any sort of crisis, there is no need to do it alone. Dial the 988 Suicide and Crisis Hotline, where trained professionals will handle your case and get you the help you need any day, anytime. All reports are fully confidential. Dial 988, and a responder will do everything they can to assist you. Remember, if you see something, say something. You may just be saving someone's life. Remember, 988 for the Suicide and Crisis Hotline.
We have John Mattinger here. John, I am so excited. We are live on Facebook. You are up. I am not because, like I said, I almost scared my listeners today, feeling under the weather. But I thank you so much for joining us. At the top of the hour, I told our listeners that you were a former narcotics agent, criminal investigator, and the author of this amazing book, Fact, Not Fiction, Lethal Doses, The Story Behind the Godfather of Fentanyl. Welcome to the show.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Amazing book. But before we get into the book, can you tell us more about your background, John?
Yeah, sure. I was a narcotics agent, the Bureau of Narcotics in Oklahoma with state narcotics in Hawaii, where I grew up. And I was a treasury agent for 22 years.
Wow. The expansive history there. The book. Okay, so... amazing read. People have to read it. If anybody has been touched with fentanyl or drug addiction in their family, I don't think there's anybody out there that doesn't know somebody. Let's discuss why they want to read this book. Tell us a little bit about it before we dive into it deeper.
Sure. Well, this is kind of the origin story for fentanyl, actually. It's how fentanyl first came to be on America's streets, and it goes back to one particular individual, a person by the name of George Eric Marquardt, also known as Squeak, who was a genius chemist, even though he was completely self-taught, never graduated high school. And he was the first person to bring fentanyl out in and put it on America's streets in any quantity. And that was back in 1990, 1991, 1992. And at that time, he was the only fentanyl chemist and distributor in the entire country. So, you know, we've obviously come a long way since then.
So George Marquardt, I've done a little reading on him. He started experimenting at the early age of like 12 years old and was like his own self-practicing chemist, which absolutely amazes me.
He broke bad, if you want to use that expression, which definitely applies. He broke bad when he was age 12, making bootleg moonshine in his family basement. And he, within 2 years, he made a batch of several batches actually of heroin for the family doctor who was addicted. And from that point on, for the rest of his life, he was a drug manufacturer. He even told a federal judge in one of his sentencings that he didn't have an occupation outside of being a career drug manufacturer. So for the next 35 years, off and on, that's what he did.
So, John, how did this country recognize that this was happening, that fentanyl was an issue and a problem in this country? I mean, I know your story begins back in 1991, but when did we realize it was a crisis?
Well, it's gone through several stages, and I'm not sure everybody's familiar with the background of fentanyl, but it was first developed as an anesthetic in Belgium by Janssen Pharmaceutical in the early 1960, I think he got his patent. And it was used as an anesthetic pretty much in a hospital setting for the next 20 years. It was only approved in the United States for use as an anesthetic, very valuable anesthetic. Most of the cardiologists, people that do cardiac surgery, say those types of surgeries, bypasses and that type of thing, be impossible without it. It's a drug that's listed on the World Health Organization's list of essential medicines. So it's very valuable in pharmaceutical setting, a medical setting. As a street drug, it wasn't ever out there until until Marquardt put it out there in 1991. And of course, then everybody realized that we had a problem, because the first weekend it was out, it killed 13 people. And in the following few weeks, it killed dozens more, including a bunch in Philadelphia, as a matter of fact. And that, when they were getting their fentanyl out on the street, he was putting it out there. They were the only ones doing it. So it was a limited amount of fentanyl out on the street, and it was competing with the heroin market, and it kind of got lost in the shuffle. Now, when they were busted, when his organization was busted in 1993, that was the end of fentanyl. It went from multiple overdoses in all over the United States, really, mostly on the East Coast, to nothing, basically, back to fentanyl wasn't seen on the street until about 2005, when there was a lab in Mexico that the DEA and the Mexican police found, and that had been putting fentanyl out on the street, and then it died out again until about 2014, and that was when the Mexican cartels and the Chinese, mostly the Chinese at the time, were sending it out wholesale into the United States, making tons of money and killing a lot of people. And if you look at a graph of the fentanyl deaths, you just see at 2014, the graph of opioid overdoses goes from like this to like this. I mean, literally, almost shoots straight up, and that's all fentanyl.
Wow, that's amazing. So now we're dealing with fentanyl again. It's a crisis in our country. Where is it being manufactured here, or is it, as the news keeps shouting, being brought in from other countries?
No, the fentanyl today is kind of ironic, actually, because when Marquardt had his lab, he was operating his lab in Wichita, Kansas, little house in Wichita, Kansas. And when they busted him, that was it. There was no more fentanyl. And there really haven't been more than one or two other labs in the United States after that. And none of them were very successful in getting the fentanyl out on the street. What happened was it all moved offshore. At the beginning, in the mid-teens, 2013, 2014, 2015, was manufactured in China. And China was sending it to the manufacturers in China were sending it to people here in the United States through the mail and whatever, container shipping and that type of thing. It's very, very potent drug. It's 50 to 80 times more powerful than heroin. So you don't need a whole lot of it to get through customs or to be concealed in whatever. And so that went on for several years. The Chinese sort of semi crackdown around 2019. They actually made fentanyl manufacturing illegal, I think, for the first time in China. And at that point, the Chinese chemical manufacturers and people in China began sending the precursor chemicals, the chemicals that you need to make fentanyl, to the cartels in Mexico. And now those chemicals, that's the way that the traffic is going today. The chemicals are manufactured in China, which has 25,000 chemical companies operating. India has 80,000, and there's some traffic from and precursors from India and other countries, but it's mostly going to Mexico, and then the Mexican cartels control the distribution and get it across the border from Mexico.
Wow. So this really didn't seem to surface as much, even though it was going off and on through the years until, like you said, 2019. And then they started sending the chemicals to make the drugs.
Yeah. That's what's going on today is that the chemicals that you need to make fentanyl, and they're not super exotic chemicals. One of them's aniline, which is what puts the blue in blue jeans. They're not really, exotic chemicals, but when the drugs were being manufactured in the United States, DEA can monitor those chemicals. They get reports from all the American chemical companies that if there's a suspicious transaction or something unusual, they'll send that report to DEA, and some of them are mandatory if you purchase certain chemicals like phenylacetic acid. Those chemicals are monitored by DEA and tracked, and they have to be reported. Well, that's not the case with China. DEA hasn't got any access to who's selling what and to whom from China. So that's the problem that we're facing today, is that there's no way to monitor the production of fentanyl, and there's no way really to get a handle on the distribution of it, because it's all taking place offshore.
John, is this influx, more of an influx of fentanyl here in our country, happening all over the world, or is the United States the biggest buyers of the drug once it's formulated?
Well, we don't actually supply it. I mean, the drugs come in from fentanyl comes in from Mexico, and some right. still comes from foreign countries, but we're definitely major consumers. But the problem exists elsewhere. It's been a problem in Eastern Europe for a long time. Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, some of the countries in Central Europe, and in Canada. Canada's got a big problem with fentanyl also.
Wow, my head is whirling with a million questions to ask you, and I don't even know how to put them into focus to sound uniform in questioning you. Is there any way we would see a crackdown on this? Is it even possible?
Well, it's possible, because it's up to the Chinese. It's going to be up to the people that are manufacturing. And the Chinese, I don't see any sign that the Chinese want to crack down.
It's a moneymaker.
They've pretty much, yeah, and some of those industries are actually subsidized by the Chinese government. And they know that they're manufacturing fentanyl precursors. So that until the Chinese decide that it's at least partly their problem, I don't see that they're going to do anything about it. There's been congressional hearings, and there's been testimony by drug enforcement people and Homeland Security people about fentanyl importation and the role of the Chinese Communist Party in distributing it. I mean, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but the fact is that the Chinese, a lot of these companies are either controlled by or they're very close ties to, mostly by money, to the Chinese Communist Party, which they have no incentive to crack down on it. And, I don't have sympathy for them, but I understand where they're coming from, because China was in the 1800s had opium forcibly pushed on them by the British and the Americans, and they went to war over that twice. There were two opium wars in the 1800s in China, and China lost them both, and as a result they had to accept opium, which was coming from India at the time, and British India, and they had to accept that, and they wanted to get rid of it. They tried to get rid of it. They made a big effort to do it, and they lost the war, so they were forced to accept it. And then that happened again to them in the 1930s when Japan was trying to take over China, and before World War II began, and the Japanese were manufacturing heroin and morphine and producing opium in areas of China and Korea and putting it and paying for their war effort with the profits that they were selling those narcotics to the Chinese. So the Chinese have a long history of being on the receiving end of this. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they look at it now and say, hey, you know, well, this is not our problem. And now you know what it feels like to be on the receiving end. And I think that's a legitimate possibility for them.
But yet not a fentanyl crisis in China.
Oh, no, because the Chinese, when they want, they have very strict drug laws. My understanding of the Chinese policy about drugs is that they'll give you one opportunity to go through rehabilitation, and the second time they shoot you. So it's not, there's, you know, if they want to solve the problem, and giving them credit after World War II and after they dispensed with the Japanese traffickers, and when that was over, China made a very successful effort to become drug-free. I mean, they were extremely ruthless, and they killed a lot of people doing it, but they succeeded in reducing the amount of drug abuse in their society by quite a bit. So today they have relatively lower amount of drug problems than we do, far less than we do in terms of addicts on the street. Now, you just wouldn't see that in China. You would not see that kind of thing in China. But they did that through very draconian measures. And if they wanted to, they could do it again. I have to conclude that they don't want to.
Well, John, you have such an extensive background in narcotics enforcement. Can you tell me how meth plays into all of this and who's been using meth and how that correlates to fentanyl?
Well, methamphetamine, Squeak, for example, in the book, that's one of the reasons that he came to Oklahoma, was because he was looking for a drug that has the profit potential. He wanted to be able to sell it, and he didn't find that with the drugs that he'd been making, sort of recreational drugs like LSD and mescaline, that type of thing. They came to Oklahoma, which had a big market for amphetamine, and he produced meth, and that was the way he financed his lifestyle, as a meth chemist, sort of like Walter White, a little more versatile than Walter, but that was the way he made his money, and he turned to fentanyl at the sort of urging of some other people, including a major organized crime figure in where he was incarcerated in Lewisburg Penitentiary. And there really isn't a connection between meth and fentanyl. One is methamphetamine is a stimulant, and fentanyl is a narcotic, more of a sedative type thing. They're two different user sets. Fentanyl is basically replacing the American heroin supply. It's replacing the heroin that used to come from Afghanistan and Southeast Asia and Turkey, and it's being made in Mexico. So it has the potential that's the market that fentanyl is impacting, is the heroin users, and those people are the main consumers for it. Although the difference between the reason why I say fentanyl is kind of a game changer for us is that it's now being consumed by people who aren't seeking fentanyl, who don't go out looking for it. They're people that maybe want to take it. They've got a back issue or something, and they take a pill, and it looks like Vicodin, or it looks like oxycodone, or it looks like a tranquilizer pill counterfeited in Mexico, and it contains fentanyl, and it contains a lethal dose of fentanyl. And a lethal dose of fentanyl, they're not even, the scientists and medical people aren't even exactly sure what a lethal dose is. They think it's about 2 milligrams. That's basically a couple grains of salt. So it doesn't take much to get a lethal dose into somebody. And that's the issue that I have with it now is I look at it and I go, well, you know, these people aren't heroin addicts seeking heroin necessarily. They're people who are looking for some pain relief or relaxation or whatever, and they think they're taking something, but it's not. It's fentanyl. So that's kind of the difference between this drug and all the ones that have come before it. And the other difference is that this stuff is extremely, extremely lethal. It's very dangerous to even handle it is risky. And it's very difficult to get a regulated dose into people, into their packages. That's one of the things that Marquardt, when he was, he warned his people in his group repeatedly, hey, this is going to kill people. You've got to be very careful with this. It's not safe to cut. It's not safe to dilute. There are going to be overdoses. There are going to be deaths. And they went into it with their eyes wide open, obviously, but he had a very good sense, even back in 1990, that this was going to be something that was going to be deadly. And that's how it's proved. That's exactly how.
Yeah, 100%. Now, you talk about how he brewed LSD for Timothy Leary and the Grateful Dead, and methamphetamines for the outlaw motorcycle gangs, nerve gas for Idaho Nazis. Oh, my gosh, the list goes on and on. So I have to ask you, John, how did you come to know George Eric Marquardt, otherwise known as Squeaky?
Yeah, good question. I met him first in 1976 when I was a narcotics agent at Oklahoma Bureau of Narcotics, and he was an informant. He'd come to us with a story about an associate of his who had ripped off his laboratory. The two of them were partners together, and they had a lab, and Squeak left and went to left town for a weekend with a girlfriend and came back and the lab was gone. And so he went to OBN and said, hey, I know where you can find a drug lab. And it was at this guy's house. And he became an informant for us for off and on for about the next 15 years. So that's how I met him. Originally, I was going to be an undercover agent on an operation, and he was the informant in that operation. It didn't work out because he was running a meth lab at the same time, and he got busted in that. So I kept in contact with him over the years. He eventually wound up going to prison behind the fentanyl case in 1993. He didn't get out until 2015, and after he'd done about 22 years of his 25-year sentence. And I met with him a bunch of times after he got out, and I communicated with him while I was in prison. And we talked about the book. And this is a remarkable story, a remarkable person. This is a guy who never graduated from high school. He was kicked out of high school for truancy. And on the same day that he was kicked out of high school, he won the Wisconsin State Science Fair. So this is a guy who's very talented chemical. He was considered a genius by the chemists who knew him, by the DEA chemists, and everybody else that ran into him said he was easily the best and most dangerous clandestine chemist that DEA or OBN had ever encountered. He was definitely a dangerous individual. Focused completely on manufacturing drugs. That was his thing. He was never going to change. I'm not supposed to like the guy because I know that he's responsible for a very large number.
You liked him, didn't you?
I did like him, and most everybody else that I talked to, prosecutors, judges, I talked to a lot of people writing this book, which took 15 years. And they all say, you know, I shouldn't say this, but I kind of like the guy. He's very personable, very charismatic individual. He had a very warped sense of morality, but he had a moral compass. One of the DEA agents said, yeah, he's got a moral compass. It just doesn't point north. And I don't know which direction it points, but definitely not north. And that was him. He had a moral compass, but it wasn't. I'm not real clear on which way it pointed either.
Okay. You know what I find interesting? I find that you're given a comparison to the fictional story Breaking Bad, and their character Walter White, and then of course Marquardt. Do you see the similarities, and did they consult you for that?
Well, I worked with I talked with the science advisor for Breaking Bad. I haven't talked to anybody from the show. I talked a lot with Squeak about it when we were meeting. We had a lot of discussions about how the science was portrayed and how Walter White behaved as a criminal. He didn't have much respect for the guy, but it's fiction on television, and you can't completely accurate. The big difference between Walter White and Marquardt was that Walter White was making meth, and he did a good job of it. According to the TV show, he made this, you know, unique blue, perfect meth. And Squeak never limited himself to meth, even though that was his moneymaker. He was able to make almost anything that you could put in front of him. He made AZT for AIDS patients at one point. And he was working on another drug called Taxol, which is a medication for cancer preventing curing treatment medication. Very complicated synthesis, and he was working on that. And he would make anything that you would pay him for, and that's how he came to make the, you know, life saving drug like AZT. But when somebody asked him to make nerve gas, he would do that too, as long as you paid him.
Wow. So if, first of all, I have to say your book is better than any fiction TV show or any fiction book that's out there. I mean, this is facts. So what became the inspiration for this? The fact that you met him because you were a narcotics agent or an investigator? What inspired you to do this? Because it's an amazing read, listeners.
Well, everybody that talked to him remarked about the fact that he is a unique character. I would sit there and ask people and say, hey, you know, what do you think about this guy? And they're all like, never met anybody like him, never seen anybody like him before or after. He was a unique character. And because I stayed in touch with him when he was in prison, we were talking about doing a fiction book, because there were telling his life story would implicate some people. Whitey Bulger, for one, in Boston, the Boston Irish mob guy was a fugitive, and he didn't want to talk about him while that guy was out and running around loose. And so there were some other people that he was reluctant to talk about, but after they passed on, and this is been back in the 90s, 80s and 90s, we're talking about. So most of the people are gone now. And we were talking about doing fiction, but he eventually came around to like, well, I'd like to tell my story. And it's such an amazing, unique story. Very sobering, because this guy is, I mean, you think about what's happened with fentanyl in the time since he was involved and busted in 1993, how this has gone on to affect the entire American, all of America, really. It's very sobering, because he was the first, and he was absolutely unrepentant, absolutely would not apologize or say he was sorry for what he'd done. So, you know, how do you square that with, you know, with the other part of him, which is, you know, kind of a likable, kind of personable kind of person. Definitely, he's killing. The DA credits. I mean, I hate to say that word, but they counted at least 126 people that they know he killed with fentanyl overdoses and or poisonings, and the number is probably closer to 1,000 at least over the 2 year period.
Oh my gosh, this is amazing. I'm going to skip my commercial break because I'd rather have the 2 minutes, extra minutes with you. What is the difference between the Fox Nation series and your book?
Well, the Fox Nation, they bought the rights to use the book. We worked together on that and produced it, actually went and filmed in Philadelphia, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. And so the Fox Nation, the Godfather of Fentanyl, that's sort of, the book covers much more in depth than the TV show, obviously, but it's a good way to get introduced to Squeak and to the fentanyl subject. And this is something everybody should be informed on. I think we should all have a good idea about what's going on with fentanyl and, you know, where we are as a society with this, and how it came to be that this is out there today.
John, it's a leading cause of deaths among Americans aged 18 to 45, with approximately 2,000 deaths each week contributed to opioid overdoses. And it's a stark reminder, your book, which came out in August. So for anybody that didn't know about it, please go look for Lethal Doses, the story behind the father of Godfather of Fentanyl. What can we do? Is there any way to stop it?
You know, I don't really think there is, unless we can get foreign governments to cooperate, and the two foreign governments that we need to get most cooperation from is China and Mexico. Without that, I don't think there's any possibility of stopping this stuff. The other alternative, and I mean, I think this is controversial, is the possibility that you would legalize an alternative to fentanyl that narcotics users, former heroin users would be able to get on a medical prescription, and would be able to get it medically. Sort of like we're doing with medical marijuana now. That way you would be at least guaranteed that you're not getting fentanyl, you're getting a regulated, controlled dose. I mean, I can't really advocate that, but I can see that as a potential solution. Right. I think that you would get a lot more addiction with that approach. You would get a lot more people who are addicted if they could obtain cheap, easily obtained, clean, pure heroin.
Or it could be, I guess, watched while you, like they have for people that are addicted. You can go and get a dose. I forget what it's called.
Methadone.
Thank you. Yes. Where you can get a dose and you're monitored. Maybe that would be the way to do it. Has the government come to you? I mean, your book is just fascinating. My head explodes. And I'm sure it will for all of our listeners. Can you tell me more about the government? Have they reached out to you with your vast background, you know, as an investigator, as a narcotics agent, knowing how this is manufactured and how it's getting into our country? Have they reached out to you for any ideas or thoughts on how to stop it?
No, I haven't talked to anybody from the government about it. DEA originally was providing assistance on the book, and then they change management or somebody and decline. But I, obviously they're much more aware of what's going on with fentanyl than I am. And I mean, I'm completely retired now, and they have much more information or knowledge about where fentanyl is and where we're going with it than I would. I just don't think that anybody has any solutions that are absolutely guaranteed to work. It's really, really a problem. You know, one of the things that I noticed with this, and this is really, to me, was really frightening, was when I started writing this book, which was back in the early 2000s, really 15 years ago, I would say I'm writing a book about fentanyl, and people would go, well, what is that? Right. And I'd explain it to them. And then as the time went by, I would, and past 2005 or into the 2010 time period, I would say I'm working on a book on fentanyl, and they'd say, oh yeah, I've heard about that. It's really bad news. And then it would be, you know, I know somebody whose cousin, brother, friend, roommate died from that. Mm-hmm. And then it was, you know, my nephew died from that. And most recently, I had conversations with people that lost two sons to fentanyl, or a father and a son to fentanyl. And I mean, it went from being, I've never heard of it, to being the most personal experience, negative experience that you could possibly have. And that's very frightening. I mean, that, to the fact that it's touching so many people in such a personal and lethal way. I mean, it's not a good thing for American society.
It just slays me, because the border is such a huge issue, which we know it's coming in from both north and south, correct?
Yeah. And from China directly, yeah.
And from China directly. So it seems to me that with all this going on and border crossings and everything else, and which hasn't been solved for well over 40 years plus, it sounds to me like the government needs to redirect their focus and figure out another way to handle this, because the way that they're doing it isn't working.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure there's a law enforcement solution here. I don't really see. When it was just Squeak, he was the only one making it. And DEA knew that it was all coming from the same laboratory. When they're doing their analysis, they can analyze the fentanyl chemical content of it, and they say, hey, this is all coming from one place. If we can find this place, we can stop it. And that's exactly what happened. When they found it, it was over. That was the end of fentanyl. Well, you can't do that anymore. I mean, there's just no way to get to especially without the cooperation of Mexico, and Mexico is not cooperating. So without that, I just don't see that there's a law enforcement solution to this.
Right. Right. So all this screaming and bickering going back and forth, I tend to agree with you as well. It doesn't quite work. Your book is just so intense. I can't stress to our listeners that they really need to go check out your book, Lethal Doses, The Story Behind the Godfather of Fentanyl. Do you have something else? Do you have something else coming down the road? Are you writing a second book?
Actually, I've been kind of like working on a book I call the Payback Time, the Opium War Against America. And I'm kind of looking at the involvement of the Chinese and the Mexican government and how it's affecting the drug problem in the United States. So I'm looking at that, but this book took a lot out of me, and I'm trying to take it a little easy for a while.
I noticed in your dedication, you dedicated this book to the memories of several of the agents that you worked at the Oklahoma Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, who you said chased Eric Marquardt by the light of the moon. Rest in peace, friends. Did they work with you on this case? You said they chased him. So obviously they were very much involved.
Yeah, that was an expression that he used. He said that he looked at this as being a great game. It was the best game in the world. And he said that to a Tulsa reporter. He said, there's nothing like it. It's the being chased all over the land by narcotics agent all over the land by the light of the moon. And that's what Oklahoma did. When we knew that he was a major problem for dangerous chemists, and they sent agents as far away as Washington, Oregon, Minnesota to try and find him. And he was just stayed one step ahead and came back to Oklahoma where we caught him. And,
wow.
And so, yeah, all of those guys that were named in the book, they've all passed on now, and they all worked on the case involving Squeak.
John, I invite you to come back anytime if you want to discuss this, if we want to talk about it more, especially if I see my questions filling up, I'm going to reach out to you. Where can our listeners go for more information and where can they find your book?
Well, for more information, I'm trying to put information about the fentanyl problem. I put information on my website about treatment options and that type of thing. I'm going to put more on my subject here when I get the time about the Chinese and Mexican connection and involvement. But my website is johnmattinger.com or godfatherofentanyl.com. It's easy to remember.
Okay. Great book. And I know that you can also find that on Amazon. I thank you so much for joining us. We are so out of time. My words of wisdom for our listeners today, always trust your inner voice. It will keep you going on the path you've chosen. John, author, narcotics agent, criminal investigator of the book Lethal Doses, The Story Behind the Godfather of Fentanyl. Excellent read. Anybody wants something to read? You can't put it down. So I encourage everybody to run out and get this book today. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
You're very welcome.
It was great. And listeners, next week, we will be back with another great author to join us on the show. You're going to have to listen tomorrow morning to my other show, Home Improvement Fix and Facts, to find out who that is, because I'm out of time. Make it a great week. Pay it forward. Do something nice for somebody. Thanks for listening.